Lester Brown founded World Watch. He was its president for 26 years as it published the valuable annual State of the World report. His latest book is called Plan B, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. Get more from the website at www.earth-policy.org. That's earth-policy.org. Here we listen to the keynote speech given to the annual gathering of the Friends, the Quakers, on July 9, 2004. Lester Brown gives the big picture, drawn from more than a quarter of a century studying the human impact on Earth. He warns that environmental damage has stressed the world's food supply. For example, we are using up our reserve grain supplies, and farming has reached a peak point due to climate change, soil damage, and other factors. Brown also warns we are using up future water supplies already, as aquifers that took thousands of years to accumulate are being emptied for cities and desert communities and agriculture. In the second part, Lester Brown shifts to positive solutions for our predicament. He calls it Plan B. Plan A is to just keep on going on our catastrophic course. Plan B gathers alternative energy, like cars fueled by wind power and hybrid engines. We see another side of Enron's Ken Lay, learn about population control, and the urgent need for cities to recycle their wastewater. This is Must Listen Radio.
Those of us who've been working on environmental issues for many years, including many of you who are here, we've been saying for some time that if the environmental trends of recent decades continue, that eventually we'll be in trouble. What was not clear is what trouble, what form the trouble would take, and when it would come. Excuse me, I now think it's going to come on the food front in the form of rising world food prices and within the next few years. Let me explain why I think this is the case. In each of the last 4 years, world grain production has fallen short of consumption. We have covered that shortfall, and the last two shortfalls were the largest on record. We have covered these 4 years of shortfalls by drawing down world grain stocks, which are now at the lowest level in 30 years. Now, this year, it's clear we're facing a fifth consecutive grain shortfall. The only thing we don't know at this point is the size. It looks as though it's going to be much smaller than the previous 2 years. But the fact that we are facing another shortfall means that at the end of this year, world grain stocks will drop to the lowest level on record. The last time grain stocks were this low, 1972-74, world wheat and rice prices doubled. There are a couple of reasons for this, a couple of environmental reasons for the shortfall and for the resulting decline in stocks and decline in food security, I might add. One, well, first we've had a number of long-standing environmental trends like soil erosion. The cumulative effects of soil erosion gradually reduce the productivity of the land. We've had expanding deserts, and I could talk for the next hour about desertification, expanding deserts in various countries in the world and what it means, whether it's Nigeria, China, Algeria, Iran, any number of countries where this has become a serious food security threatening issue. But there are two new environmental trends, falling water tables and rising temperatures. These are trends that the world's farmers have not had to deal with before. But as the world demand for food has tripled over the last half century, the demand for irrigation water has also tripled. And in many parts of the world, that has led to the overpumping of aquifers. Half of the world's people now live in countries where water tables are falling and wells are going dry. And these countries include China, India, and the United States, the big three grain producers that together account for nearly half of the world grain harvest. In the United States, water tables are falling throughout the southern Great Plains and throughout the southwestern United States. In the southern Great Plains, the water tables have fallen to the point where the irrigated area has shrunk by 24% since 1980. Not only are farmers faced with a shrinking supply of water in many areas, like California, for example, but farmers are getting a shrinking share of that shrinking supply. There's a magazine that comes out of California. It's called The Water Investigator. And each month, it has a section in it on water sales. Almost every day, there's another water sale in the western U.S., a farmer or an irrigation district selling their water rights to cities, because cities can pay so much more for the water than they can earn from using the water for irrigation. So we're seeing farmers now with a double squeeze, a shrinking water supply as aquifers are depleted and wells go dry, and a shrinking share of that shrinking supply because cities throughout the world are taking more and more water. In India, water tables are falling in most states, including in the Punjab, which is the breadbasket of India. In China, water tables are falling throughout the northern half of the country, including under the North China Plain, which is the breadbasket of China. Overpumping for irrigation is a way of expanding food production today that almost guarantees a decline in food production tomorrow when the aquifers are depleted and the wells go dry. We are quite literally borrowing water from the future. Most of us do not realize how water-intensive food production is. We drink each day, in one form or another, as water, juice, milk, pop, beer, coffee, whatever. We drink nearly 4 liters a day. That's almost 4 quarts of water a day. The food that we eat each day requires 2,000 liters of water to produce, or 500 times as much. It takes a lot of water to produce food, and when you're doing footprint analysis, that becomes quite clear. I think many of us in this room now sense that the world is facing the future of water shortages. If it is facing a future of water shortages, it is also facing a future of food shortages. Most of us have not yet connected the dots to see that water shortages equals food shortages. 70% of all the water we use, that we divert from rivers or pump from underground, is used for irrigation. Industry uses 20%, cities use 10%. So falling water tables is a new problem, and it's shrinking harvests in many countries, importantly in China, which I'll come back to in a minute. The second trend that is affecting food production is rising temperatures. New research by crop ecologists at the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines and the U.S. Department of Agriculture indicates that for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature, that's 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature during the growing season, we can expect a 10% decline in grain yields, wheat, rice, and corn. In 2002, intense heat and drought reduced the grain harvest in India and in the United States. Last year, Europe bore the brunt of intense heat. London, for the first time in history, recorded triple-digit temperatures, that's Fahrenheit, 100 degrees. Every country, from France east through the Ukraine, saw its grain harvest decline as a result of intense heat during the last half of the summer last year. 35,000 people died in 8 countries in Europe from heat, from record temperatures. That's 10 times the number who died on September 11th, 2001. When we look at the future, we see rising temperatures. In fact, when we look at the recent past, since 1970, the Earth's average temperature has risen 0.7 degrees Celsius, well over 1 degree Fahrenheit. And it appears to be accelerating. The four warmest years on record, the record goes back to 1880, the four warmest years on record have come in the last 6 years. So if you look at the temperature rise, it's rising. Temperature trend, it's rising. We know that CO2 levels are rising. We measure them with great precision, even to the nearest tenths of a part per million. We measure each year. It is the most predictable environmental trend in the world. It goes up every year. We can measure CO2 levels very precisely, and the trend is headed in the wrong direction. In the Journal of Ecological Economics, I read about a family visiting a natural history museum in Boston. And they were looking at the skeleton of a dinosaur. Well, you've seen them when you've been to a natural history museum. Rather impressive. And they were trying to figure out how old the dinosaur was. But they couldn't find any information on the inscription describing the dinosaur. And shortly, the building engineer walked through. And they said, "Sir, can you tell us how old this dinosaur is?" And he said, "Yes, the dinosaur is 65 million and 12 years old." They said, "Wow, how do you know that?" "When I came to work here 12 years ago, in science, that's known as the law of misplaced precision. Some things we know very, very precisely, like CO2 levels. Others we don't know so well. We know CO2 levels are going up every year. Temperature does not go up every year. It's going up in a lot of years, but some years it actually declines somewhat. We're looking at projections for this century by the International Panel on Climate Change, that group of some 1,500 scientists that the UN has organized to study the Earth's climate and to project changes. They are projecting that the Earth's average temperature will rise somewhere between 1.4 degrees Celsius and 5.8 degrees Celsius. 5.8 degrees Celsius is over 10 degrees Fahrenheit during this century. Some people recently born may live to see a planet that is 10 degrees warmer than it is today on average. It's going to make it much more difficult for farmers to keep up with the demand, for farmers to feed 74 million people each year with water tables falling and temperatures rising. We were talking in a group this afternoon, and I was pointing out in response to questions that I think the wake-up call is going to come in the form of rising food prices. And the event that I think it's going to trigger this dramatic rise in food prices will be when China comes into the world market for massive quantities of grain. Between 1950 and 1998, China increased its grain production from 90 million tons to 392 million tons, increased its grain production more than fourfold. One of the great success stories, one of the great economic success stories of the last half of the last century. But since 1992, its grain production has dropped to 322 million tons, a drop of 70 million tons in 5 years. One of the reasons is spreading water shortages. There are other reasons. The conversion of cropland to non-farm uses and the economy that's growing at 7 or 8% per year means a lot of buildings are being built. Factories, warehouses, stores, homes, and they're beginning to develop a love affair with the automobile in China, just like in the United States. 2 million new cars sold each year. That means for every million new cars sold, you have to pave the equivalent of 100,000 football fields. If you can visualize 100,000 football fields. It takes a lot of paving, roads, streets, parking lots, to accommodate automobiles. The drop in China's grain production, 70 million tons, exceeds the entire grain harvest of Canada. Thus far, China has been covering this decline in its grain production largely by drawing down its once massive stocks of grain. But they are now largely depleted. And with wheat, it has already turned to the world market. Wheat-buying delegations from China to Australia, the U.S., and Canada have bought 9 million tons of wheat since the beginning of November. automatically making China the world's largest wheat importer. But China will shortly be importing not only more wheat, more than that, but also rice, large quantities of rice and corn, which is the principal feed grain. Wheat and rice, the principal food staples, corn, the principal food grain. When China comes into the world market for 30, 40, 50 million tons of grain, more than any other country imports by far, it will necessarily come to the United States because we control close to half of the world's grain exports. So we're looking at a fascinating geopolitical situation where we have 1.3 billion Chinese consumers who have a trade surplus with the U.S. of $120 billion. That trade surplus alone is enough to buy the entire U.S. grain harvest twice. So it's not a question of will the Chinese be able to compete with us for our grain and drive up our food prices. They will. Now, 30 years ago, if any country had done that, we would have lowered the boom and said, and we would have restricted exports or even embargoed exports. But today we have a political stake in a stable China. China is not only the economic engine powering the Asian economy, it's the only large economy in the world that's had a full head of steam in recent years. The entire world has been leaning on China to keep the world economy growing. Within a few years, I fully expect we will be loading one, two, three ships a day of grain heading across the Pacific to China. That long line of ships is going to tie the two economies together with an intimacy that we've never experienced before, with China or indeed with any other country. Managing the flow of grain between the U.S. and China in order to and trying to satisfy the interests of consumers in both countries will be one of the big foreign policy challenges of the years ahead. We're moving into an era that's new, that's different from anything we've known. For the Chinese, it will mean for the first time in their history, they will be heavily dependent on the outside world for part of their food supply. And for us, it will mean that, like it or not, we're going to be sharing our food with 1.3 billion Chinese consumers. It'll be a new world. Now, remember, we started with environmental trends, like falling water tables and rising temperatures, soil erosion, etc., the conversion of cropland to non-farm uses. These environmental trends then have an economic effect, rising food prices. Rising food prices, particularly if we had a doubling of grain prices, which is a distinct possibility, it would destabilize governments in a lot of low-income countries that import a substantial amount of grain. This political instability could disrupt global economic progress and begin to affect the Nikkei index, the Dow Jones 500, and so forth. At that point, we might realize that we can no longer continue to neglect the environmental trends that are undermining our future, like falling water tables and rising temperatures. That, I think, may be the wake-up call. There is no economic indicator that is more politically sensitive than food prices. I'm convinced that Plan A, business as usual, is simply not going to work much longer.
That concludes the first part of a speech given by Lester Brown, the founder of World Watch Institute, to the Society of Friends on July 9th, 2004.